Accession number 14932, Norman Edwards, reel 6.
Mr. Edwards, reel 6. We were just talking about your time in mainly in Heberturn, facing Gomercore Wood, in the Somme area, from summer through into the winter of 1915 into 16, with odd bits about Sayre, but that's beside the point, really. Did you ever have to do listening post duty or going out into no man's land to act?
So did I what?
Ever have to do listening post duty or go out into no man's land to cover working parties or things like that?
Oh, yes. And occasionally patrols would go out and either lie out or see if there was any Germans in the Red Hedge. That Red Hedge became quite a characteristic in our... position.
Would you ever go out with those patrols?
No, because the machine gunners were supposed to the colonel. I remember one of our men named Waldron. The fellow got to middle.
This is Owen Waldron. Owen Waldron. Wally Waldron.
He asked the colonel one day if he could go out, and he said, "No, I'm not going to sort of risk one of my skilled machine gunners." There's plenty of ordinary infantrymen can do that.
Did he used to go out anyway, though, Waldron?
Did he what?
Didn't Waldron go out anyway?
He did. On one or two occasions he went out. When there was an official patrol going out, he would certainly try his best to join it and be allowed to. And I think on one occasion the colonel allowed him to go out alone, prowl round the Zed Hedge, but he didn't meet anybody there.
Did you ever feel the urge to do anything like that, or was...
No, I'm afraid I didn't. I was there to do my job, but I didn't want to stick my neck out to capture a German or do anything like that.
What did you feel about Waldron then? I mean, did you admire
him? Well,
we've
got the greatest admiration for him because he was a fighting, brave man. No doubt about that. One of the extraordinary... probably the answer to that question is that he finished up with a DCM and a bar when he was in the ranks, and a military cross and a bar to it when he was commissioned.
Now, another point that you mention in your memoirs is that you sometimes acted as cook, presumably for the machine gun section. Do you remember that, acting as cook for the machine gun section?
You'd get any bits of nice dry wood that wouldn't give too much smoke, and I think I may have mentioned that one night I went out at the back of our trenches to see if I could find any nice dry wood, and I came across a board flat lying down, and I looked at this thing, and it was a white board with a black line down the centre, or vice versa, I forget which now. I think it was a black line down the centre. So I took this in, chopped it all up into small pieces, put them in the sandbag. We got plenty of fairly dry stuff for the next few days. And the next morning there was quite an array of artillery officers who came round and said that the marker marking the division between A division artillery and B division had disappeared. And so I was able to say, well, there was some heavy bombing from the Germans, which was true, but I didn't tell them that I'd found a board and chopped it up in bits. Also, I might have been court-martialed myself. But we had some nice dry wood for making fires with.
And what would you cook? Would you just heat up the tins, or would you do anything more imaginative, or was there nothing else you could do?
Well, bacon, you see, was the main thing. To cook a bit of bacon in the morning, first thing. That was the main thing, really.
Would you heat up the tins of McConaughey's and such like?
Well, you could warm up McConaughey's, yes, in a tin. But bully beef itself didn't improve by being warmed up. It was just bully beef.
Now, one thing I wanted to ask you is that that at one point you had an officer who was very keen on you keeping the trench tidy, very, very tidy trench. Do you remember?
Oh, yes,
that?
Yes. Sometimes officers would come round and say, disgusted, look at those trenches, empties down there, get it tidied up. And it was one of those things that sort of helped to keep the discipline tight. One didn't object to it.
What were you meant to do with the rubbish, the empty cans, say? I mean, what would you do?
Bury it.
You wouldn't throw it into no man's land, then?
I don't think so, no. I think we used to bury it at night, but sort of behind our own front line. A lot of occasionally, of course, parcels that come from home, you had to get rid of the string in the brown paper and boxes and that type of thing.
Now, at one point, you used to have battalions come in for training, and the Manchester Regiment sent a battalion at one point, and they had Lewis guns. Was that the first time you'd seen the Lewis gun?
Well, that probably wasn't the first time, but of course I got later at the end of 1915. The machine gun corps came into being, and all the main Maxim gunners were transferred. But the colonel said, "I'm not letting every man go. I must retain one or two experienced Maxim gunners to train people on the Lewis gun." I was one of those chosen, but I hated the idea of losing touch with all my intimate friends. But I soon found very good friends in the infantry. I was simply in charge of B Company's Lewis guns.
Now, what do you remember? You had training on the Lewis gun on the 1st of December 1915. Yeah. What do you remember of your training in the Lewis gun? And could you describe a bit? Because you then went on to train your company, didn't you?
Well, we were sort of back behind. You first of all had to there was a circular drum. You had to learn how to fill that with ammunition all the way around.
Was that easy?
Yes, pretty easy. It's all the markings there. Then you drop that onto a pivot on the gun, I see. And that was all then ready for firing. And you press the trigger and this would circulate this till the whole, I think it was 25 rounds or thereabouts, 25 to 30 rounds. As you fired this thing, it would bang, 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 like this. And the thing would be coming turn round slowly but surely till it was out of action. And you could off with that drum and put another one on quite quickly. And of course, your number two man was the fellow keeping the drums fitted with the ammunition.
Now, was it a reliable gun? It was air cooled, wasn't it?
It was air cooled and left it entirely. It was much more mobile, if I put it that way. You haven't got a fixed tripod, that sort of thing. You could put the gun and sort of bang it there and bang it there. It was a very good weapon.
No,
we didn't think much of it. We thought it was a very ordinary weapon after a Maxim gun.
Why? Well, what didn't you like about it?
Well, I know, because the Maxim gun was supposed to be it. You can talk about your rifle, you can talk until you stifle, you know.
So it wasn't really a rational thing, not liking the Lewis. It was just prejudice based on you having had maxims.
It did a different thing, you see. By the grace of God, we, as far as I can remember, I cannot remember any real attack by the Germans on us where you could put the maxim gun on and spray the whole area. So I had an opinion that the maxim gun was the gun, and the Lewis gun was a rather second-rate weapon compared to it.
But what could the maxim do that the Lewis couldn't?
Well, it could keep a steady fire of 250 rounds at a go.
So the belt, the fact that 250 was more than 29 or whatever it was.
It had there been a German attack in mass with a maxim gun playing on it, the Lewis gun, you see, I forget now whether it was 25 or 30 rounds, you'd have to stop, change that thing, put another one on, there was a gap.
So that was the main difference in your view. Any other differences other than
quite handy, and of course the Lewis gun was a handier weapon because it hadn't got to be, no tripod had to be carried by a second man.
Now I'll come back to it when you leave, because I've got some other points before you leave the machine gun section. But another lesson you had was bombing classes. Yes. With Lieutenant Carden. What do you remember of that, the bombing training you had?
Well, I never went on a course for bombing, but there were courses for it. You first of all had to get used to this Mills bomb, where you held the thing like that, pulled the safety pin out, and then the trigger, if you let go like that, the trigger would sight the 5 second fuse. So in the ordinary way you'd have a Lewis gun, a bomb rather, you pull the thing out with a circular thing and a split pin holding thing, hold that tight, and then like that, and as soon as you let go the thing, the handle went forward and started a fuse, a 5 second fuse in the bomb. And then you get the explosion.
So you'd almost bowl it with a round arm action.
Yes, they were the things.
Now,
as far as I remember.
Now, you say you didn't have. I thought you had a course in cricket ball bombs in December 1915. Do you remember that?
They may have had a. We didn't see it. The only ones I can remember were Mills bombs. There were some earlier type, rather circular ones that. I believe there was one where they had to light a fuse and throw it, but that was very ancient for us.
Now, another thing, back to machine gun sense, you mentioned that a lot of them, an experienced machine gunner could almost play a tune on the machine gun. They'd play a rhythm, that sort of thing, on the machine gun. Do you recall that?
You could do it. Yes, you know that. How can I describe it? You do. Something that, like that sort of thing.
And did that take a lot of skill to get that?
Well, you had to sort of do it on and off. I know that once the colonel once said, what was it? He said something about, do you understand that are you transmitting an insult to the Germans with this? We said no, we're afraid we didn't know enough German to do it with a. We simply did it with this dum diddly dum 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 dum. That was the favourite sort of thing, you know. Dum.
Now, when you weren't at Kuan at Heberton. You went back to Kuan. I'm not sure how you pronounce it. C-O-U-I-N. The village.
C-O-U-I-N. Kuan, yes.
Kuan. What were your billets like there?
Well, that's it. It's easy. A farmyard, and there was a barn, and there was a wall between. And one side with the thing leading, the roof leading up to the wall, and the other side. And half the section were put on the north side, and half were allotted the south side. It meant you could put some straw on the floor, and you could have, save from rain, you could sleep there. And we were known as the Bible class and the mission.
How did you get those names?
Oh, I don't know. It just sort of arose.
Now, there are photographs. I mean, was the farm in occupation? Were there any French?
No. It was just a sort of catchword, rather than abusing.
No. Were there any French farmers still on the farm?
Oh yes, yes. They were there. And
because there's photographs of you helping.
Photographs, there's pictures of them. I'm talking to them. They talked. They used to call us the Gloucesters, Gloucesters, Gloucesters.
From your name. Did you get on well with them?
Well, we didn't have any trouble with those people. No, they were. Of course, Kuan must have been about. Oh, I suppose 3 miles behind the line.
Did you help on the farm? Because there are pictures of you almost.
There were cattle there on the farm.
Did you help with farm work, though, at all, when you were out?
Yes, we helped them over the harvesting time.
What would you do?
Well, help carry the stuff and put it on the limbers to be carried about.
What about the estaminet? Was that where Suzanne's estaminet was?
There was quite a good estaminet there with a I think a lady, a girl behind the counter named Mary, M-A-R-R-I-E, Mary something. And we had a suspicion that they used to put French beer into British bottles and charge us British bottle beer prices for it. But we weren't quite sure about that.
Did you drink?
I remember the one chap, Jelly Stevens, fell for the barmaid there, and he went in and ordered a beer one day and held it up to it and said, "Son Bonte, mademoiselle," instead of Bon Sante.
That was, I mean, there's a picture of Jelly Stevens, and it says, "After one too many, it's Suzanne's."
Yes.
Was Suzanne's the name of the estaminet?
Yes.
Well, another thing is that there were machine. A lot of your photographs have pictures of various anti-aircraft machine gun posts. Do you remember that?
I'm doing what?
Anti-aircraft, getting machine guns onto anti-aircraft. Could you?
Well, that was a brainwave. We had one man named Toogood, who was a very brilliant. How can I put it? A chap who used to think up bright ideas. And we were talking one day about why these Germans coming overhead and, you know, firing, and that the old Maxim gun's elevation wasn't more than that. So we found a place that had been bombed by the German, where there'd been a coach, and we found that the wheel and the axle of one side of it were all right, so we cut away the rest of the stuff. We mounted that axle in the ground with a wheel round here, and then mounted the tripod on the wheel, with the result that you could then get an elevation of, oh, quite considerable from this area. And also you could follow the Germans round as they came. So that if German airplanes came over, we could give them a dose of entertainment.
Did you find it easy to hit? I mean, could you actually hit them? It's quite difficult to hit a moving plane. I mean, was your fire accurate at planes?
Well, on one occasion we think we got a direct hit on this aeroplane, because there was some sign or the other, smoke or something came out of it, and I believe the thing landed in our lines rather than the German lines. But it was a good feeling to be able to hit back at them. That same engineer chap, that too good fella, I think he made a mention to you before, we got rather fed up with tune. And somebody said one day, why can't we have a bit of roast? And he got a circular, I don't know where he got this circular from. Anyway, cut a long story short, he found a place where there was clay. So he dug clay out, put this wooden thing there, smothered it over with about 6 inches of clay, and then lit a fire inside it. It burnt the actual covering, but the clay held firm, and we had a permanent oven. And by putting embers and small pieces of wood in there, getting a good fire going, and very quickly putting them out, and then putting the meat in, you could really have roast beef. Quite an ingenious idea.
What about training while you were at Kuan? I mean, would you do any training? What sort of duties would you be doing?
Well, the amount of training really was negligible. When we went back on leave, we occasionally had to do parades, and some of the if anybody had been wounded, we wanted to bring in another man to replace him. That chap was given training by one of the NCOs of the section.
What about training for upcoming offensive? I mean, you did a bit of training before Loos. I know that's going back. Well, but then you didn't go to Loos, but I mean...
I remember on one occasion when we had sort of semi-sports there, there was a competition between the 6th Gloucesters and the 4th Gloucesters Maxim gun sections to, at a given signal, to get the gun out of the thing, mount it and get it into the firing position. I forget who won the prize.
Right, now, we're just coming up to December. Do you remember Christmas at all in 1950?
Well, I particularly remember...
That's when your friend died, wasn't it? I mean,
yes,
Len Taylor.
Len Taylor died.
Can you tell me the story of that? He joined with you, had he, Len Taylor? How did you know Len Taylor?
Pardon?
He joined with you, had he, Len Taylor?
Well, less about the same time. I think the fact that I joined up influenced him to some extent. I know his parents sort of blamed me for Len joining. And anyway...
What happened to him then?
I married his sister.
What happened to Len? How was he wounded?
All I know is I was asleep on Christmas Eve. I'd been on duty. And on Christmas morning, one of my bosom friends, a fellow named Hughes Games, he was a student at Durham University for the church, came along and he said, I'm sorry, Knocker. By the way, my nickname was Knocker. He said, Len has been killed by a shell burst. Shell came over and hit me. He was all wounded down around the... He wouldn't have been any good as a man afterwards, but I'm afraid he's died. But worst Christmas I ever remember.
What was your morale like, would you say? You'd been there nearly a year. Your morale, your own morale, how did you feel? I mean, were you getting nervous, or were you getting more confident, or getting depressed? How did you feel?
I suppose we were getting more confident, really. We knew we were reliable Maxim gunners. We were doing our job, and that was it. That's what we joined up for.
You weren't getting nervous with the shelling or anything? It wasn't affecting you?
I don't think so. No, I don't think we were what you call nervous. We used common sense. For instance, if they were shelling a certain place, you'd go to ground, and that sort of thing. But as far as I remember, there was no sort of funk or you know, trying to get out of things. Yeah.
Did your religion help at all? Did religion help at all to get through it? Or were you aware of it?
I think so. Whenever it was possible to have a service, sometimes you'd have a communion service. I remember one communion service within gunshot. Actually, no bullets actually came over, but it was on the edge of a wood, which was very impressive.
And did religion help you?
Undoubtedly. I've got in my souvenirs now. I still got a little testament which I carried, and there's certain bits marked carefully in that.
Were you aware of the contradictions of being religious and being at war at the time?
Well, I felt we were doing the right thing because the Germans had broken all the sort of rules of, they were trying to overpower people and that sort of thing. It seemed the right thing to do.
Now, at this point, this is on the 23rd of January 1916, your machine gun section was disbanded, as you've mentioned already.
Yeah.
A process that started in December, and some of your friends went to the machine gun corps. How did you feel? Was Wally Waldron, Owen Waldron?
Oh, well, I am not. Wally Waldron and Bess Ayres and Sergeant Brown, all those intimate pals that we become got to know one another, were all taken away, and I was sort of one left behind to train men in B Company with them. I hated it for about a time.
How did you go?
I gradually got to do friends in B Company.
How did you go about the training? I mean, how would you train men in the Lewis gun?
Well, whenever we were out of the line, we used to go to a place where there was a firing range. You'd show them how to load the gun, how to aim it, and how to shoot with it. And also, for quite a long time, I was training men in the front line, showing them how to load it, fire it, and so forth.
Were there any problems with the Lewis gun in the sense of, would it jam, or was there anything wrong with it?
Well, occasionally you'd get a stoppage, and there were certain well-known clichés. I can't remember what they were now. Like the one and only one I can recall so well.
You mentioned that the one
was the crank handle on buffing spring.
That's a maxim. You don't remember.
I don't remember anything in the Lewis gun that any sort of lay down rule. There may have been a few rules, but
would it jam easily, or was it a would the mechanism of the Lewis jam easily, or what would cause it to jam?
That I wouldn't know. I suppose dirt would get into it, or something of that sort, but on the whole, they were pretty reliable.
Now, were you still only a private, or had you been promoted at this point?
No, I was still a private. I think just at the end of the 1915, when the other boys were taken away, as I was then in charge of them, I was made a corporal.
Not a lance corporal, a corporal. Did that make a difference?
I was made a lance corporal, and a few days before the Battle of the Somme broke out, I was given my second stripe.
Did being a lance corporal make a difference?
Well, yes and no, I suppose it did. It sort of marked you up that if anybody wanted to know anything about the Lewis guns, whether you wanted to put a Lewis gun else, a soft officer would come along and say, "Are you the corporal in charge?" "Yes." "Well, I want a gun located at A, B, or C, D." You would then do it and take your team and there. I always remember once on one place I'd been taken onto the north edge of our section of the battalion, and there was a very noisy night or dawn, and I wasn't quite sure, but I assumed that the Germans had raided. So I thought, well, it'll help. They've got to come from their trenches down to us. So I got the gun where I thought they might be, and I fired two or three canisters of things. And it was rather amusing. The day afterwards, I was just there. Nothing was happening. Sun was shining. When an officer came down the trench and said, "You in charge of this gun?" I said, "Yes, sir." He said, "Did you fire it the night before last when that raid was on?" "No," he said. Why didn't you fire it? And I said, "Why didn't you fire that gun on such and such a night? Because then the Germans raided us." And I was rather hurt by this, because I said, "What do you think these are?" And